Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
I am not doing this for work-life balance purposes. At least I can see those benefits. But I started this journey for saying, how do I improve productivity in my business? And I say to business leaders, you know, all over the world, you've got to approach this from the perspective that this makes sense for the profitability and productivity of your business. And if you're going to do anything, you know, do this. Because it's relatively simple to implement, but the results are, you know, extraordinary in terms of what it will do.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Rick Brinkman, co-author of Dealing with People You Can't Stand, and Alex Osterwalder, creator of the Business Model Canvas, then check them out after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Andrew Barnes. He's the architect of the 4-day week and author of the book with the same name. Andrew conducted an experiment in his own business, the New Zealand trust company Perpetual Guardian, and asked his staff to design a 4-day week that would permit them to meet their existing productivity requirements on the same salary, but with a 20% cut in work hours. The outcomes of this trial, which no business leader had previously attempted on these terms, were stunning. People were happier and healthier, and more engaged in their personal lives, and more focused and productive in the office. That was the surprising finding, the productivity improvement. The story of Perpetual Guardian's unprecedented work experiment has made headlines around the world, and many companies all over the world are adopting variations of this idea. In our discussion today, Andrew talked to me about the increased productivity that they found from their 4-day work week experiment, the relevance of the 4-day week idea to a post-COVID world, and other benefits to society of the 4-day work week. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Andrew Barnes. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Auckland in New Zealand, Andrew Barnes. Andrew is a serial entrepreneur. He's a speaker. He's a podcaster. He's the founder of Perpetual Guardian and also author of the 4-Day Workweek. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Hi, Jürgen. Good to be here.
Catherine Lloyd, who was our guest on episode 259 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we talk with you, Andrew. So a big shout out to Catherine. Big hello. Now, Andrew, you spend much of your time making the case around the world for the 4-day work week, and you kind of pitch it as something that can help address some of the ills of the current global economy. And that was a pitch that you wrote when you first launched it. Now, with what's happening now with the coronavirus pandemic, we're hearing more and more about the future of work and how what people are being forced to do now in the current environment is going to impact on how they'll work once we get through this and, you know, finding innovative ways to work and do business. So I think the subtitle of the book gives a lot of insights into what that might look like, and that's how the flexible work revolution can increase productivity, profitability and well-being and help create a sustainable future. So I'm really excited to be exploring that with you a little bit more today, and also in light of what we're going through right now. So as we're recording this in mid-April, you're on fairly strict level 4 lockdowns. We're on level 3 here, so we're allowed out to exercise and for shopping and critical tasks, but that's about it.
Well, you need a wine business, Jürgen. I've got a wine business that's apparently designated as an essential industry.
All right. Yeah, alcohol. Yep. Well, the alcohol consumption here has gone up quite dramatically as well. I think that was the next thing people started stockpiling after toilet paper. All right. Anyway, before we start talking about all things 4-day work week, tell us a little bit about how you came up with that idea and how it all got started.
Well, essentially, I was on a plane flying to London. I was reading an article of The Economist magazine, which had an article about productivity in the United Kingdom and Canada. And what it basically said was that the Brits were productive for 2.5 hours a day and the Canadians for 1.5 hours a day. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Why is that happening? And is that happening in my business? And I thought, you know, probably people, you know, come to work, have a cup of coffee, bit of a chat, get down, answer a few emails, get distracted, go on the internet, get interrupted. You know, statistically, I think it's once every 11 minutes. And I thought, well, what would happen if I gave my staff a day off a week in exchange for the same level of productivity, but would I get a change in behavior on those 4 days? In other words, would they eliminate some of those unproductive activities? And so literally it was an experiment. I didn't expect anything more than to try a little trial and see if the behavior in my own company changed.
Mm. And what was your experience in those early days? Because that's quite a bold kind of move.
Well, not if you think that you're only productive for 3 hours a day, right? And that was the point. I then stopped before I sort of said to the team, let's do this. I did a little bit more research. And frankly, survey after survey was indicating exactly the same thing, about 3 hours of productivity in a day. So if you think about that, you only have to find 45 minutes more productive time in each of 4 days to make up for the lost day. Now that's still, you know, 4 hours out of a 7 and a bit hour day. So there's still bags of time for socializing and water cooler chats. So I didn't think that was a particularly big risk when we initiated the trial. I thought, well, there's a good chance we will get better productivity. And I also thought that, you know, that would also give my staff a chance to be the best they could be outside the office, as well as the best they could be in the office, because they would be, you know, fresher, they'd have more time with the family, they'd be able to deal with those interruptions, those things that disrupt the working week. So I thought, well, it's not that much of a gamble. I mean, I wasn't game enough to make it permanent straight away. We decided we'd do a 2-month trial. But when you actually think about it, the risk of failure was probably not that large.
Hmm. And how did you measure the productivity? I mean, did you kind of benchmark your productivity beforehand rather than just take that kind of statistic that you'd read about from other studies?
Well, here's the thing. How many businesses really know whether their staff are productive or not? Now, I would argue the bulk of us have absolutely no idea. We use time as a surrogate. We look at the week and you come in on a certain time, you leave at a certain time, and we go, that's productive. Well, if you believe that your staff are productive from the very first minute to the very last minute of the working day, I think you're kidding yourself. So what we actually did is we said to the team. We said, you've got a month before we initiate this trial. So what we want you to do in that month is do two things. It's to tell us how we should measure you. Now, in some bits of our business, measurement's very easy, you know, billable hours, documents produced, whatever it is. But in other bits of the business, especially those bits that are providing services behind the scenes, it's quite hard to identify what productivity actually is. So what they did is they said, well, you know, looking at an average week, this is sort of what we do. This is how you should measure us. Bizarrely, we had to tweak a lot of that down a bit because, frankly, we had a view that they weren't actually as productive as they said they were. It's one of those interesting psychological outcomes that staff sort of think they make more, produce more than they actually do. But the real purpose of that was actually also for them to identify what they shouldn't do. How much of the day was actually unproductive? Because what we've done here is we have made time the limited resource, not cost. So in a business traditionally, we think about cost saves. This was about time saves. So suddenly people start to go, well, should I be doing that? Am I wasting my time doing that? Am I wasting your time doing that? And so the process, that first month of planning, was to establish the benchmarks so that we had an idea around productivity in probably a more granular way than we had. But it also alerted the teams to say, actually, we need to rethink about what we're going to do and how we're going to do it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think, you know, the point of looking at what am I doing that I shouldn't be doing, and I guess one of the interesting things for me, looking at, we're kind of looking at a lot of our activities right now and saying, what's the outcome we're aiming for here, rather than what's the activity? So we're kind of taking a bigger picture view. And that kind of highlights some things where we say, well, that actually, the outcome that we're after is not dependent on this activity. So why are we doing it? And so looking at activities that you're kind of doing because you're used to doing them, or because they've become routine, or because you're looking for a distraction. I mean, it, you know, and this is not just the staff, this is the business owner and the senior management. Everybody's looking for distraction every now and then. And there's nothing wrong with having distraction every now and then. But of course, you know, the more you can keep that down, reduce that, the more efficient you're going to be. So, How did it impact on your customers, though?
Well, that was the other thing that we said. Look, there could be no adverse impact on the customers. That was an absolute prerequisite. So when we talk about a four-day week, we don't mean that we shut the shop for one day a week, because we don't. We have retail branches the length and breadth of New Zealand. So we have to service our customers normal business hours, exactly the way we would have done before. So what we said to the teams is that you have to structure yourselves within your team, you know, who's taking what time off. And that could be, you know, some teams might do it on a rolling basis that they took a day off. But actually, we said we were prepared to be even more flexible than that. You can take a couple of afternoons off a week. You can come in late, you can go home early, you can do whatever you like, because our four-day week is really about output, and it has to, by definition, it has to be a voluntary opt-in process. Now, we're currently at about 76% of the company on a four-day week. We will never get above 85%. Because whenever you join the business, we do start you off on 5 days. So you understand what the 5 day job looks like before you have to deliver it in 4 days. So by doing it that way, actually, in most cases, actually, our customer service has improved. Because if you think about when somebody goes on holiday normally, what you do is you go, oh, someone's off, gone off on holiday. Well, we'll try and cover that until they get back. Now, when you've got somebody off in your team every single week, you can't do that if you are going to deliver the same standard of service. So, in fact, what we then found is that we got better team resilience, much better cross-training. People started to work out who would cover that role, whether they had the right skills for it. Now, this sounds and is like a rehearsal for COVID. Because that's exactly what we've got now. We've got an understanding of what productivity was. We have resilient teams that can cover each other. And so actually for us, COVID is, it's unfortunate clearly, but from a corporate point of view, it really almost nothing changes because we've done the work around understanding productivity, understanding resilience, and understanding how people cover other people's roles. And that's put us in really good stead for this.
Yeah, that's a fascinating insight that, yeah, I guess people, as you say, they adapt the systems and the processes and the handoffs and also the upskilling each other in a way that enables them to take time off during the week rather than simply sort of as an exception to the rule when somebody is going on vacation once a year, or maybe, you know, some people don't even take vacation once a year. They may do it once every other year or so.
No, that is the point, because everybody, when we do it, you opt in as an individual, but your team is the team goal. And again, because of the way that New Zealand legislation worked, we couldn't change your contract. So your contract is still 5 days a week, you know, 8:30 to 5. You opt into the policy. Now, that means that if you don't deliver your side of the bargain, i.e. the productivity, the organization has the right to say, well, everybody back in for the fifth day. And we've only ever had to use that sanction once. We had one team actually in the trial that failed because it did what you were talking about. You're going to, what it basically did, he said half of them said we'll take Friday off, half said we'll take Monday off. And then we got to the end of the trial and they said, well, customer service really suffered. And we said, well, that's why nobody else in the organization did it that way. They all did a rolling routine. But it was helpful for us because it proved that we meant what we said, which is you get this time off if you deliver on the productivity. If you don't, back to the normal way of working.
So what in the trial, I mean, obviously, you know, the trial was successful enough for you to continue with it. How long has it been going, by the way?
We've been doing this now for just over 2 years.
So what were some of the surprising things that you found during the trial and even after that?
Well, look, there were things that you would expect, you know, engagement scores, you know, engagement, enrichment, empowerment, enthusiasm, loyalty. Those scores went up 40%, to levels which the researchers said were the highest they'd ever seen in New Zealand. Our stress levels dropped again. You would expect that, about 15%. But the one that jumped out of the page was that more of our staff said that they were better able to do their work working 4 days rather than five. And that was the one that we didn't expect. Because we expected people to say, actually, I'm under a little bit more pressure. But they weren't. And the reason they weren't was because they found that they could eliminate so much of this busyness, the wasted time, and they came up with lots and lots of little hacks. So we have a thing like a call a quiet hour. You know, you put a flag in a pot by your computer that says, if I've got that flag there, do not disturb me for an hour. And that means, of course, that person is able to concentrate, get the complicated tasks out of the way, if you believe the 11-minute, 22-minute rule, you know, 11-minute, you're disturbed every 11 minutes, takes you 22 minutes to get back to full productivity. You know, that itself is probably the equivalent of 3 hours of work right there.
Hmm.
And so that combined with changes about how we structured the offices, rules about you couldn't eat your lunch, so your reheated curry didn't waft over your colleagues at lunchtime, where you did your social calls, and if you couldn't trust yourself to keep off the phone, you could lock it away. All of those little things combined with 20% fewer people in the office, it dropped the noise levels, actually meant that people were getting more work done. They were not socializing. They're not doing what they normally did, but actually the time that they were working just delivered more output.
Yeah, it's fascinating because some of those hacks are actually things that people recommend working in the online space to prevent interruption, because when you're working in the online space, as many people will be discovering now, the ability to be interrupted or for somebody else to interrupt you is much easier because, you know, they don't have to be in the same office. And hence, you know, your email might pop up and notify you that there's something going on, or you get notified that there's a new Facebook post by one of your friends. And so, you know, the conventional wisdom there is turn off all those notifications, and the online chat systems that people use to work in teams online have the ability to essentially put up that flag in a virtual sense. So, you know, turn your light to red, for example, and say do not disturb right now. So yeah, it's interesting that you've applied those.
Yeah, it's coming. That's exactly right. We've just applied them. We applied them in the office, and now actually again for the teams at home, they've learned those lessons. They've learned those lessons over the last 2 years. So consequently, you know, child care permitting, you know, if at the moment obviously we've got school kids home in New Zealand, but childcare permitting, actually those lessons have been learned, and therefore people are applying those self-same disciplines in the work from home environment as they were applying in the work environment. But it's not rocket science. It's all the stuff that if you read, you know, any time management book, it will say the same thing. It's just that we've given people a huge incentive to do it, which is if you do these things, you get a day off. You get, you know, you only have to work 80% of the time. And that's a very powerful thing.
Hmm. Yeah, I can imagine it certainly is a powerful motivator as well. And in the current environment where that's the exception rather than the rule, it would definitely mean that your company is probably a much preferred workplace or a preferred employer. And so you have the choice of high demand for people wanting to work for you and therefore choice.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we were saying, again, pre-COVID, if you looked at most of the Western economy, certainly the US, UK, New Zealand, I think Australia wasn't far off it, you almost had full employment. So competition for talent was becoming acute. Now, I can tell you, you know, we're in the trust industry. You know, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to work for a trust company. We are seriously dull, right? And yet we have talent queuing down the street to work for Perpetual Guardians, because actually what we do isn't that dull, but it's not that. It's about the philosophy that underpins the company, that we are prepared to innovate and we're prepared to try different things as a workplace, which basically means people say, well, I will choose to work for you. And I use the example as well of Microsoft in Japan. So you know, Microsoft trialed the 4-day week in Japan last year. They got a 39.9% improvement in productivity off using Microsoft Teams, no meeting longer than half an hour, no more than five people in a meeting. Now, if you are a software engineer in Japan now, who do you want to work for?
Yeah, that's right. All right. One of the things I'm curious about, I mean, and this is a question that you address in the book, I know, that would it work in all industries? Because a lot of the pushback you've gotten in your quest to spread the message is that people say, well, it wouldn't work in my industry. I can see it easily how it would apply to a service industry or something like what Microsoft does, where you know people are in offices, they're producing something that is kind of a virtual product. But what about a manufacturing situation where you're physically actually on an assembly line, things have to be assembled physically by people that are driving machines or stocking warehouses or whatever it might be?
Well, helpfully, we have Metall AG in Germany, which is the union that deals with Volkswagen. And they have been on a four-day week for some years, working a 28-hour week. Now, that's not quite our model in that they're on a 28-hour week and they have a pay structure that is adjusted a little bit to take account of that. But nevertheless, I don't put the Germans at the bottom of the heap for productivity. So it's actually in manufacturing, it's a lot easier than you think, because no manufacturing plant works on the basis of one shift.
Yeah.
And in fact, most manufacturing plants will probably be running, or certainly big companies will be running 24 hours a day, will have multiple shifts. Fine. You just adjust your shifts accordingly. It's not that hard. You know, you think about what we do when we talk about this. We say that the real issue here is that you approach your staff and you say to your staff, what would you do differently in order to work a reduced hours week? And they will tell you, because the benefit to them is time off. If you come from top down with a cost-based approach, they won't necessarily tell you because they know that will cause a job loss.
Yeah.
So the psychology of this is to say to your employees, look, you know, we're not talking about job losses. We're talking about getting better productivity by you working better, and tell us how you would eliminate those things. And it doesn't matter whether it is agriculture, manufacturing, service-based industries, any industry you care to name, I will find you a company that's doing four-day week somewhere in the world, in either that industry or in an industry that's so closely aligned you could use that as a template.
All right. Now, we touched on COVID before and the situation that we all find ourselves in right now in the middle of April as we record this. A lot of people working from home, a lot of people actually losing their jobs because businesses unfortunately have cut staff in order to save costs and attempt to survive through the crisis. How do you see the four-day work week movement applying to a post-COVID world? And what do you see as some of the changes that will come in as a result of COVID, but that are relevant to like the four-day work week movement?
Well, the first thing is, I think inevitably, I don't know again what the situation is globally particularly, but here in New Zealand, there is an awful lot of discussion around companies, organizations, when we come out of this, because economic activity will be lower, that a lot of companies will look to do a four-day week with reduced pay. And that is a reaction to straightened times. Now, interestingly, Russia last year announced that they were drafting legislation for a four-day week. They were doing it for precisely that reason. They were doing it for unemployment reasons and saying that actually if we can job share by creating more jobs, because we're going to reduce the amount of hours, they weren't going to reduce wages, that will create more employment. Now, what we're working on at the moment with certainly some of the unions here is to start to talk about what are the options. You might start on a four-day week reduced pay, but you want a commitment to get back to full pay. But why shouldn't we take the opportunity to get back to full pay, but not increase the working week? Why can't we use this as an opportunity to, change how we work? And part of that as well is that we're looking at whether it's possible to partner with the government and say to the government, well, look, in the short term, why don't you continue the subsidy? But instead of subsidizing the bulk of wages, subsidize a bit of the 20%, the pay cut, if you will, provided that companies are, first of all, engaged in this process to improve productivity and bring in a four-day week. But secondly, that your staff, a proportion of that time is spent in training, upskilling, or if we're talking about an environment where AI could potentially destroy, some statistics, say 40% of jobs. Well, isn't this a great time for us to use this to re-educate our workforce? Training on the job reduces productivity. Doing it this way wouldn't necessarily reduce productivity if we're able to get everybody to produce the 5 days in four. So that's the movement we're looking at. The reason we have to tread carefully is in Ireland at the time of the GFC, the public sector unions there, for example, agreed to go down to 4 days, agreed a pay cut. And then when they came out of the GFC, they said, right, everybody back to 5 days, but they didn't put the salaries back up. And so, thanks very much. That's not helpful when you're trying to be creative. So we're playing around with this, but we do think that this is the best opportunity we've got to actually rethink how we work and to hang on to, some of the benefits. I don't know, again, what it's like where you are, but the skies are clear, the waters are clear, pollution has dropped away. Well, how do we hang on to that? We've got more people spending time at home with their families, broadly, probably better family cohesion, probably better communication, less stress. How do we hang on to that? So I think if we're going to get anything positive out of COVID, we have to rethink how we're going to do things. And certainly that's where we're trying to pivot the 4 day week campaign at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question to ask, is how can we hang on to some of these changes that have been essentially forced upon us, but they're kind of almost collateral benefits, if you like. I was reading the other day that for the first time in living memory, I think for people that are alive right now, you can see the Himalayas from New Delhi, which is quite astounding. When I think of what New Delhi looked like every time I've been there, you were lucky to see your hand in front of your face. But the other thing, of course, people are now have learnt how to run virtual conferences online and so on that they hadn't done before because they felt no need to it and they preferred to do in-person stuff. And suddenly they realized that, hey, there's benefits to doing these virtual things because now I've suddenly got a global audience.
Yeah, that's right. I had an interesting conversation with one of my CEOs this morning, and what we were talking about is, in fact, whether what we're going to see is a complete inversion of the way we work. And the concept we were talking about was actually that maybe you will only come into the office one day a week, and you'll come into the office not to work, but to socialize with your colleagues face to face. And the rest of the time, you'll work from home. Now, that means, much smaller offices, they're probably just meeting rooms, your cafe, coffee shop area. But you know, that could be a model that we start to get out of this. It's almost complete inversion. You work at home and you socialize with your colleagues at work.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. And like you say, it that would certainly cut back on, you know, the congestion on the roads, the impact on, you know, public transport systems being overcrowded, and the resultant drain on the environment that some of those things cause.
And the 2 points about that, of course, is that, you know, we know here that if we could get Auckland to free flow, in other words, we could get traffic off the roads, that would add about 1.5 to 2% to Auckland's GDP. It will be the same in almost every one of the major cities. So in an environment where we need to get the economy to recover, a four-day week is a tool that would assist in that. And then if you think about flexible working generally, you know, flexible working, the estimates when you look at what it would do to global economy, it would put trillions of dollars onto the global economy. So grasping this as part of a strategy that we use to help the global economy recover, for me, it makes, you know, I have to keep emphasizing this whenever I talk about the four-day week. You know, I am not doing this for work-life balance purposes. At least I can see those benefits. But I started this journey for saying, how do I improve productivity in my business? And I say to business leaders, you know, all over the world, you've got to approach this from the perspective that this makes sense for the profitability and productivity of your business. And if you're going to do anything, you know, do this, because it's relatively simple to implement, but the results are, you know, extraordinary in terms of what it will do. And most companies that implement productivity policy as ours is, are seeing improvements of productivity of, you know, 25, 30, 40%.
Yeah, that's a really valid point. I mean, you've talked quite a lot about how to sell it and getting the teams on board and getting the teams to identify how they improve their productivity and how they implement a four-day work week. And of course, there's heaps of benefits for the team members in terms of work-life balance and better relationships and less travel and all the things we've talked about so far. But the productivity thing is what comes back to the business in the bottom line.
Yeah, that's right. The only reason you think I'm a nutter is I'm telling you that you can improve your productivity by your staff working less. Everything else makes sense.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, if you chunk it up a little bit and say, you know, if a business owner does the right thing by his employees and his team members, generally they will do the right thing by him. And it's like,
yeah, that's, you know, you look up, concept, you know, look, isn't it?
look after your employees, they look after your business and look after your customers. Yeah.
There's no rocket science. There is not rocket science, but it is finding the way to do it that everybody feels comfortable, and we can be glib about it. You know, it is a challenge for business leaders, but if you do it in a structured way, you know, our advice is, you know, bit of planning, bit of a trial, and then go to an implementation after you've had time to draw the conclusions. You can do it in a very structured, low risk way. You don't need to change employment contracts. You don't need to do all of those difficult things. You just, you know, follow the simple steps. And the biggest message is, don't overthink it. It's when you overthink it that you make it complicated. It is genuinely quite simple to do.
Yeah. Well, don't overthink it, I think, is a good bit of advice that can apply to a lot of things. I do need to ask you, do you work a four-day work week?
Not anymore, because I have to spend all my time talking about the four-day week, which is a problem. But again, without being glib, I don't work in the company anymore. I haven't for a while now. My senior leadership team do work a four-day week. They are the only people in the company who have to work a four-day week. Now, are they doing some work when they're at home? Probably. But this isn't about the people who want to get to the top of the tree. You know, and this is the Elon Musk issue that you don't change the world unless you're working 100 hours. The reality is there's one of you and there are millions of people who just want to get a decent wage, to be able to have a good life, to bring up their kids. They don't want to be you. They want to have a balance. So my leadership team have to walk the talk. And if they don't walk the talk, then nobody will follow suit. I got down to 4 days for a very brief period, but because we have about five or six different companies in the group and they're all over the world. But what I did do, and I do to this day, I took email off my iPad. And when I go to the island at weekends, we live on Waiheke, I don't have my phone. So my weekend is my time. And, you know, that's the key part of this. Whereas before, you could guarantee I would work 7 days a week. So we call the policy the 100-80-100 rule. 100% pay, 80% of the time, provided we get 100% productivity. Now, that means that can apply whether you're working 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days, 1 day. You apply the formula to the time that you're working. It also means if you're working 60 hours a week, try and get it down to 50. It's reducing the amount of time that you're working. That's the premise here. Don't try and get it from 60 to 32 because that's just not going to work.
Yeah.
Do this in steps. This is about getting the balance back. That means that you are fresher, you're more creative, you've got more time to think, especially if you're a business leader, and therefore you'll probably find that your business decisions improve.
Yeah, definitely. I love the idea of having a device for the weekend that doesn't have the email on there. And yeah, so basically you're just using it to read and maybe connect with family.
Well, not even that, actually. I mean, literally, if I need to connect with the family, I'll use my partner's phone. But it's done deliberately because things keep coming. And then if you don't draw the boundary, and that's the lesson of COVID again, isn't it? You're home working. You've got to draw the boundary. The biggest challenge we have now is that now we don't have the get up and go to work and come back from work to punctuate the day. And therefore, it's very easy to find out that you're working longer hours.
That's right. Yeah, that's definitely one of the big challenges for working from home. As somebody that's been doing it for many, many years, that certainly is a big challenge. And thinking back to my corporate life, I was on global teams. And of course, there you've got the challenge of the time zone. So often I was, on teleconferences at midnight. But I would then take the time to sleep in till 10 on that morning. And that was okay. But you do have to set those boundaries. That's a really good point. All right. Well, this is a fascinating topic. Now, we'll touch base a little bit on where people can find out more about the 4-day work week and get a hold of your book. But I think it's a good time now to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our listener who they're primarily innovators and leaders in their field, and we're looking for some tips from your experience, and hopefully that'll give them something awesome to go and do something really innovative today.
Hopefully.
So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Time. We talked about it. You need to have time to think. I get my best business ideas walking on a tangy beach. You know, it is a fact, scientific fact, that when you've got downtime, you've got time to think. Your brain is still whirring away. If all you ever do is are reacting, you never think strategically. Time enables you to think strategically.
Yeah, that's a That is a very effective way to do it. And I find my morning bike ride, particularly now when we're doing it solo, it's a really good time to have that downtime where the mind suddenly comes up with a whole lot of ideas. Now, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Well, I think the 4-day week. I mean, because that's given all of my leadership team more time. So they're all being more creative. And therefore, they're also having more opportunity to come up with solutions. You know, it's that sort of structure that enables people to innovate. And, you know, especially in a fast-moving world, if you've got that ability to deliver that to your employees, then they in turn, you know, will deliver for you. And they're developing new ideas and new products, you know, almost faster now than I can keep pace with as we go through the last few weeks, because they've all got a little bit more time now than they had before. Going to have to send them back to work.
Yeah. Okay. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
You know, I don't. I'm the wrong generation for this. I have a little black note. I have a little black book, and so I've always been, you know, I get the book and I have my jotted points down and I have my little headings that I put at the top if I'm following on a project, and you know, I'm just too old to be moving into Trello or whatever it is. But also, to be honest, I'm traveling a lot. So for me, it's the discipline of having that book, that list, that segment things where I'm looking at. That's what I use. Other generations will use different tools, but I'm still an imperial baby, for heaven's sake. I struggle with centimeters.
How do you keep track of your notebooks? Because I imagine you've probably got hundreds of them accumulated over the time you've been in business.
Yeah, well, there is that. One at once. I did get to a point, I have to say, that I had a different book for a different business, and you know, then wheeling a suitcase around with you. So that's no good. Now, I mean, as I said, I'm a little old tech. I'm not very good with technology. I understand how to apply it. I mean, bizarrely, I mean, I've floated things like, you know, realestate.com.au was one of mine. But I don't use a lot of technology, but I have an appreciation of how technology can be used. So I'm again, it's I guess it's a generational thing. I'm still easier for me. I come from a family of artists. So I think visually, and therefore I use diagrams and drawings, which helps me conceptualize products, strategies, ideas.
All right, great. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
I'm a great believer in regular communication. When we've done the most complex transactions, and believe you me, we've done some fairly complex things over the last, you know, 10 years or so. My main way to handle that was I used to get all my senior people together in a coffee shop every morning, and we used to talk it through. We used to talk the issues, what were the problems that people had. And I used that forum as a decision-making forum. So literally, people would canvas an idea, canvas a problem, and we would resolve it there and then. Now, that was that was quite efficient, because the challenge otherwise is let me write an email, let me do a presentation, it goes into a circulation, we pull everybody together, we have a bit of a committee meeting, we get the feedback. You know, by the time you're doing that, you're wasting a lot of time. And often I find decisions can be made quickly and simply, provided you've got the key points. A lot of it sometimes is fluff. You've got the key points and you're able to have a very short, sharp discussion, make a decision, move on. And that has always worked for me in terms of driving innovation in broadly every company I've run for, you know, the last 20 years.
So regular communication, probably, I'm guessing that at the start of the day is probably the most effective time to have those kind of meetings, but also being really succinct in what you want to achieve and the outcome you want to achieve rather than a lot of fluffing around.
Yeah, yeah. And so your decision-making process at the start of the day, but what we used to do is, and we still do it, we back it up, especially if we're doing transformational projects across an organization. We then use multiple different levels of communication. Now, that can be, it could be an email, it could be a voice broadcast, it could be a video broadcast, it could be, you know, walking into a team and just doing a quick briefing chat, a morning tea with a team, whatever it is, whatever works. Because at the end of the day, you can be the world's greatest strategist. But if your team doesn't understand the goal, what it is they're going for, why they are important, then actually you'll fail. And it was brought home to me in my dim and distant days in the military, where, you know, people said nobody goes over the top for a flag. And I can tell you they definitely don't go over the top for a mission statement.
Hmm.
They go over the top for the person on their left and the person on their right.
Yeah.
And that's what you're trying to achieve here. You're trying to achieve that sense of team cohesion, understanding what it is you're trying to do. If you can do that, then your business will succeed.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, and what's the number one thing you think anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
It's take more risk, because I think quite often, you know, people look at an issue and go, oh, that's a bit risky. So actually, I'm not going to do it. Now, I always, again, have a phrase of saying, if you can look at a situation facing the company, and if you do nothing, sometimes you will have 100% chance of failure.
Yeah.
If you do something, you might have a 50% chance of failure. Now, that's a high risk, but it's a hell of a sight better than the alternative. And so quite often we don't understand risk. We don't appreciate that doing something, making a decision, lowers the risk profile, gives you a better chance of success than actually sitting there going, I'm going to do nothing. And if you know, the taxi industry, I always think is a fantastic example of that in recent years. You know, you knew something was coming, but you did absolutely nothing until you have been completely flattened. And that's a classic case in point. Change was there. You knew change was there, but you didn't do a thing.
Mm. Yeah, that's really good. So reduce the risk profile. I love that reframe of the risk. And I've said this quite often on the podcast. I've lived through the my first job was actually in the photographic industry. I lived through the birth of the digital consumer photography and lived through the reaction at the time of the film manufacturers. And
yeah.
It was exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. We've all read about Kodak, haven't we?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I lived through it. All right. Well, this is absolutely fascinating, Andrew. Now, where can people find out more about you, find out where can they get the book, The 4-Day Work Week, and maybe even get in touch and continue the conversation?
Well, obviously, it starts with the 4-Day Week book, which, of course, you can get from good booksellers or indeed from Amazon. The reason I say start there is that it's a how-to book. All profits from it are going to fund research into the benefits of the 4-day week with our global research partners in the United States, the United Kingdom, and in New Zealand. It tells you broadly how to do it. Now, you can also go to our website, which is www.4dayweek.com. We took a view from the get-go that we wanted to share everything that we'd learned. So if you go to that website, you'll find articles, you'll find research, you'll find our white paper, which talks about the results of the trial and how we implemented it. I think you'll find things like the contracts that we used, the legal opinions that we used, all sorts of stuff. So it's a great starter resource if you're just thinking about the journey. And then finally, we spend a big chunk of each week talking to companies all over the world who reach out and say, look, we'd like some advice on how we implement a four-day week. We do ask now, please either, you know, read the book or, you know, at the very least have gone through the website, because I wrote the book because I just can't drink that much coffee. You know, we got to the point that it was just never ending. And so the book gives a good base point, but you don't get many chances to change the world. And when we started this journey, we thought it was going to be a little special interest article in the newspaper and maybe something on the telly in New Zealand. And now it's run in 85 countries worldwide, a global audience of approaching 5 billion. We stopped counting the articles when they went past 4,000, double-digit thousands in social media posts. This is an issue that's coming at all of your businesses right now. Now, you either, it's not the train we expected. Heck, COVID-19 has just proven that. But it's coming, and you need to understand how you are going to respond to that. So the four-day week, we believe, is a key strategy for businesses to use to improve their productivity and, importantly, to improve the lives of their employees and their workers. So, you know, there's lots of good stuff in it. We just say to you, well, we're more than happy to help, but help us by having had a bit of a read before you talk to us.
All right, and we'll post links to all of that in the show notes. And also, as a fan of taking in or reading books through Audible and Auditory, and for those of you that are that way inclined, I can tell you that the book is also on Audible, because that's how I read it. All right, is there a parting piece of advice you'd like to leave our listener with today, Andrew?
Yeah, I'd be bold. Just be bold. I was a chicken until I was about 39. You know, I grew up in a household in the north of England. You know, parents who'd come through the war. My dad lost his dad during the war, and you know, conservative. It's frightening how conservative they were. I can remember talking to myself at 21 going, Andrew, you've got to settle down and get a job rather than, you know, go and travel around the world, because I've been indoctrinated. It took me till I was 40 to go, actually, this is stupid. I'm better served to take some risks, because, you know, life isn't a dress rehearsal. So the advice is that I would give to everybody, you know, take some time to think, but actually being innovative, being entrepreneurial, isn't as hard as you might think it is. It's that first step. It's just making that step. So, you know, take the lead.
Great. I love that advice. Yeah. And finally, Andrew, who would you like me to chat with on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, and why?
Well, if you could get hold of somebody like Ryan Pandya from Perfect Day, that would be interesting. I mean, I am looking at where, you know, protein fermentation goes, especially, you know, living in New Zealand. There are reports out there that basically say that the dairy industry could be completely replaced by protein fermentation within the next 10 years. Now, that is one heck of a piece of evolution. We've done it in manufacturing. We've done it, obviously, in technology. But agriculture, this to me is the next big wave that is coming. And that will have enormous implications, certainly for the economy here, but has incredible implications for our ability to, you know, feed, sustain the planet in a sustainable way.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll see if we can get Ryan on for a conversation and explore that a little bit more. So thanks, Andrew. And thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, and talking about the 4-day work week and the movement and all the things that you've learnt in your experiment inside the company, and then what you've learnt in helping other companies implement it. So all the best with pushing this forward, and let's keep in touch.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed that engaging and thought-provoking conversation with Andrew and took something away from his episode. Do you think you could adopt a 4-day work week in your business? What would need to change? I'd love to know, and I'd also love to know what else you took away from Andrew's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/Andrew Barnes. That is AndrewBarnes. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Andrew Barnes. You'll also find further information about Andrew there, as well as links to the 4-Day Week website, the 4-Day Week book, his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Andrew suggested that we have a conversation with Ryan Pandya of Perfect Day on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Ryan, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Andrew Barnes. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including business and marketing strategist Mariana Norton and speaking and creativity coach Will Reed. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.